Be seated, please. Court is ready to hear argument in 050925, Eula Yancey versus United Surgical Partners.
May it please the court, Mr. Denny, present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, and good morning, Your Honors. This case really has two issues that have remained undecided by Texas courts, and that is, one, whether day of the hearing replies to motions for summary judgment, including those that contain objections, should be banned, which I believe is the appropriate rule, and whether claims made on behalf of persons whose mental incompetency cannot be disputed by reasonable persons and whose incompetency arose from the medical procedure in question should be told. In this case, one of the respondents filed a reply that included objections on the date of the summary judgment hearing. The trial court correctly and wisely ignored it. But the Court of Appeals gave it effect and ruled on the objections that were made there. And I realize, while there are cases that say that some objections are not waived by a party not obtaining a ruling from the trial court, it is my position that objections should be waived when they're not timely filed. In this case, the Dallas County Court of Appeals has a local rule that says replies should be filed 3 days before the hearing. I believe that Rule 21A also has that requirement. I don't know of any judge anywhere, even in Louisiana where my office is located, that wants parties filing pleadings on the date of a hearing. It gives the judge no time to prepare. It certainly gives, as the respondent to the motion for summary judgment, when I'm handed a reply 5 minutes before the hearing, I have no time to formulate a lucid argument.
When you say any kind of reply, are you talking about objections to evidence, or are you talking about a reply in terms of legal argument on the responding to the summary?
Your Honor, I'm referring to any type of reply, including objections. And I believe in one of the briefs, I believe it's Valley Views, they even characterize that. They say, we filed a reply that included objections.
When I was in practice, the judge appreciated a legal argument. You know, you're going to make an oral argument, but to be presented here is our brief, basically, on our legal position. Whether it was on the morning of the hearing or before, it was appreciated.
Well, the Dallas County Court rules clearly say a brief has to be filed with the response, with the motion, and certainly no later than 3 days before the hearing.
But you say that's also in our rules.
I believe that Rule 21A does require that filing. And the Court of Appeals that we cite the cases in our brief have split on that, whether some say 3 days before, some say the day of the hearing is okay, but clearly due process would entitle a party to some notice of those objections. I don't think it's any burden on the movements to file their objections and their brief and arguments 3 days before the hearing.
Why does a due process require when you object to stand up and object to trial without any notice at all?
And argue cases without notice.
Well, because in a motion for summary, it's just a different procedure. Think about how skewed it is already in favor of the movement. The movement files a motion for summary judgment, has to give the respondent 21 days notice. But if that's not complied with, so what? They can file a new motion. They can reset the hearing. But as respondent, if I don't file my response within that 7-day deadline, it's stricken and it's in effect the death penalty for my case. The case is over with. If the movement has summary judgment evidence and as respondent I object to it, so what? They just refile their motion again. They can file their motion as many times as the trial court's patience will tolerate. So to cure their objections, they get a second chance. They can refile. They can cure those objections. But as the respondent, if there's objections made and they're sustained by the trial court, case is over. So the movement already has several significant procedural advantages, and this court should not add another by saying, well, you can come in on the date hearing, slap a set of objections in front of the trial court where the respondent is not prepared to argue, and not only are there no consequences for the movement, but in this case it's the respondent that was hurt, because at that point we're put in a great dilemma. The court could say, well, you could have asked the court to rule on the objections. But when the court doesn't and ignores them, certainly I'm not going to do that. The court can imagine how my client would react and say, why did you ask the court to rule on objections that were subsequently, if they were sustained, caused our case to get dismissed? There was no need to move for a continuance because, again, the trial court correctly ignored the objections and did not rule on it. The trial court did exactly what the trial court was supposed to do. But the Court of Appeals came in and said, well, we'll just revamp and I'll just rule on those objections. The summary judgment, and I think the cases where they have split, Corpus Christi court says you need 3 days, other courts have said you don't need 3 days. I just think there's just no reasonable or rational basis for allowing somebody to file something in response to a motion for summary judgment on the date of the hearing. It would be the equivalent of the parties coming in today and saying, here's our briefs, Your Honors. Now let's argue. It simply makes the court less prepared, gives the court less opportunity to be ready for the hearing, and it does the same for the respondent.
Assume all that's right, and we agree with you, and so it's established that she was of unsound mind throughout the period. Tolling statute on unsound mind doesn't apply, according to the code itself.
That is correct, and that is how the trial court ruled. The trial court
None of that matters whether she's unsound mind, except to your constitutionality challenge.
That is correct.
So you come in, you hire a lawyer. Everybody knew within a week this woman had suffered a severe injury during surgery.
That is correct.
Hired lawyers. Lawyers filed a lawsuit. But the lawyer didn't sue everybody. Was this you down at the trial court?
No. It was not me, Your Honor.
Lawyer sued some, but not everybody. Didn't sue the hospital.
That's absolutely correct.
So you're here asking us to declare it unconstitutional because the lawyer who could have sued the hospital didn't. And why should we do that?
And that the guardianship, and there's another issue, they're both, I know, probably the most troublesome issues for the court. And it's clear that Miss Yates had a guardian, her mother, but the court has never, for example, punished minors because their parents did not file suit. And there is a case.
There's a difference, though, because minors turn majors at some point. But this lady, if we're to accept the affidavits, is never going to recover, or not in any, she's not objective. So in one instance, there will be a deadline someday, maybe 20 years down the road, but at least it's 20 years. Whereas in this case, there may never be.
Well, I think there's two factors, well, really three. There's two practical factors and one legal factor. And certainly minors at some point can sue, but minors also get smarter. I mean, there's nothing smarter than a 16-year-old. Miss Yates will never have any mental capacity whatsoever. She's in bed and does nothing but breathe, essentially.
Oh, but under the rule you're arguing, she could wait, her guardian could wait 50 years to sue.
And I think that is going to be a troublesome issue for the court, but I think there is a way to resolve it because what you really have are two constitutional rights bouncing up against each other. The first is Ms. Yates' rights under the open court to have access to court and not be punished because she is completely comatose and incompetent. On the other hand, Your Honors, the respondents say, well, what about our due process argument? We don't want to be sued 50 years from now or 40 years from now when witnesses are gone and the case is stale. There's a way to resolve that. That's their due process right bouncing up against our client's open court's right. And I think this court can place some type of time limit on that because I agree that at some point, the open court's doctrine is going to bounce against due process. I don't think it's in this case for about 3 years. I think 10 years or 15 or 20. There's some point where the due process rights of the respondents override.
What should it be? Should it be, well, when you've demonstrated you can get to the courthouse, guardian, then a reasonable time after that, or that was a reasonable time?
Well, this court has said, and the case just escapes me, that you know the guardianship, there's another case where there was a guardian appointed. They said, well, that doesn't really matter.
Ruiz versus Conoco.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. And that's the same case where this court talked about how it's probably...
But that's different. That's a tolling provision where the legislature says we want people of unsound mind not to have the limitations running against them. And so this court said, okay, they said that, and they didn't make an exception for when you got a guardian appointed. You're here, this is a medical malpractice statute. This statute is a favorite of the doctors and of the legislature. And you're asking us to declare it unconstitutional as applied, throwing ourselves into grease, when the alternative is to throw the lawyer in the grease who could have filed the hospital timely. Why should we throw ourselves in the grease here rather than the lawyer? Why is it when you've hired a guardian and the guardian's hired a lawyer and filed a suit, why should we declare anything unconstitutional after that?
I think if the court did not declare the statute unconstitutional when it has done so for minors, there would be this rather bizarre that minors who at least have some mental functioning and it increases ordinarily as they approach majority, it makes no sense that incompetence, especially in Ms. Yates, if she could do nothing, that she's at the mercy of her guardian or at the mercy of this lawyer, and that she should not be punished for that. But
so fine. We'll let her sue her lawyer, her trial lawyer, for not suing the hospital on time. But, you know, you're asking us to declare one of their favorite statutes unconstitutional because of something the lawyer could have easily done.
And I realize that it is the legislature and doctor's favorite statute. But clearly, when they drafted the no-tolling provision, if any of the legislature had read this court's previous ruling, they should have known, for example, that the minor's no-tolling provision had little or no chance.
Well, they did. And that's why in 4590, they said, and no-tolling provision in the world applies to this statute. Now, we've held that unconstitutional in a few cases. You're right. But the question is why we should do it again if somebody else is to blame.
I think the fact that And in some respects, you know, I can sue the lawyer for malpractice as well as the doctors. But I think it is important to proceed to declare it unconstitutional when it's applied to someone who is permanently comatose. And this court has never held.
Well, the purpose of the tolling provision is to remove a disability. It's so that someone who cannot bring a claim, either because they can't discover it or because they're incapacitated to be able to appreciate it. But if you've got a situation where they do appreciate it because they've got a guardian who sued on it, why should we allow them to piecemeal if the purpose of the tolling provision is served?
Again, I think it's, and that's a, you know, there is, I realize an argument that I knew the court had some difficulty with because I've had some difficulty with it too. And that's something I thought the Court of Appeals, quite frankly, would resolve instead of running off on these objections. But I don't think that the court should place someone in Miss Yates' status. She's comatose. She can do nothing. Her mother's her guardian, but her mother has a fairly heavy burden herself. I mean, she's taking care of her daughter every day who is in a coma. I don't think that burden ought to be on them, especially Miss Yates, who can do nothing, that they ought to be at the mercy of this lawyer or this, or even her guardian, even her mother, who, of course, is distracted by the obvious problems with her daughter.
So when do you want us to stop it?
Well, I think at some point,
the legislature says, gives us limits. You're saying at some point, 5 or 10 or 15, what is the answer you want us to write?
I think the court ought to say that where, again, reasonable people cannot differ concerning the person's incompetency and it arose from the medical procedure in question, that it's told for 10 years.
Why 10?
That's sort of just, I mean, and you could argue 20 because the minor statute say, well, it's 20 for minors, why have it 20 for incompetence? But that's really just kind of looking at.
Of course, we don't think the legislature may have thought about that when it passed this statute, took evidence and thought about it and decided not to toll it?
I think in this case, the legislative exception, the no tolling rule, the legislature, I don't, everyone says they thought through it very carefully, but I don't think when the legislature creates a statute that is so obviously going to be punched through for constitutional issues, for example, as this court has done for minors' claims, that they didn't really think it through.
The next one comes up and they haven't filed for 10 years, and they say, well, if you let it go for 10, Judge, why not 15? Because in our case, we had someone who was incompetent and everybody knew to it. Why not 15? Don't we get into that? Don't we get into that drawing lines? And isn't that the legislature's job?
Well, and in this case, I don't know that the court has to draw a line because here we're talking about less than 4 years, which I think clearly does not bounce against their due process.
We have to draw a line because we're going to be moving a line the legislature has given us. Isn't that drawing a line?
we move it past where your clients filed.
I do, but I think in this case, again, Your Honor, it clearly, the time limit in this case does not bounce up against clearly the respondent's due process rights. And so in this case, I think that the court doesn't necessarily have to draw this line. I said 10 years. Some people argue 20 because it's comparable to the minor statute. The court could perhaps do what it did years ago when before the Texas Tort Claims Act was enacted and say, you know, there is some bright line and the legislature needs to come up with one. Just as they said, we're going to abrogate sovereign immunity unless you, the legislature, come up with this Tort Claims Act, which is how we got
it. It's just sort of hard to argue that sometimes incapacitated people won't have access to the courthouse. In this case, there was access. The person had a guardian and a lawyer.
That is correct. She did have a guardian and she did have a lawyer. And again, I think the rationale in Ruiz for not punishing the economy because they had a guardian is the same rationale here, even though it's a different, you know, it's a different statute.
And then when she did have a lawyer, she filed affidavits that are rather superficial from nurses that just say, trust me, I'm qualified, and she's not going to recover. And defendants say that those affidavits were conclusory, and assuming that the objections were preserved, why is that even some evidence?
Well, again, I think they were not, but I think in this case, and it's quite frank, there's no pleading in the record, looking record, that ever placed her incompetency at issue. She had a guardian. She pled that she was totally incapacitated. There's no Rule 93 verified denial saying we verify we're attacking the guardianship, which is based on her incapacity. And, of course, the guardianship creates a presumption of incapacity. Nothing in either motion for summary judgment can test her incapacity. And I think where the affidavit says she's comatose, that's no less conclusory than what the Court of Appeals said was okay, which was, he said that unresponsive, uncommunicative, and incapable of caring oneself is okay, but saying they're comatose or in a permanent vegetative state is not. It's such an obvious fact when she's bedridden doing nothing that it required no expert, no special expertise. It's no more than in my employment practice where we have race discrimination cases where someone says, either they say, I am of this race. Well, unless someone's put that at issue, that's conclusory.
So you don't need an expert to prove that a person is comfortable?
I don't believe you do. Okay. And Your Honor, may I finish my answer?
Yes.
And Your Honor, quite frankly, I think the affidavits were sufficient to raise that issue, especially in light of the fact there was no pleading anywhere in the record contesting Ms. Yates' mental capacity.
Other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from the respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Walsh and Mr. Rodriguez will present argument for the respondent. Mr. Walsh will open with the first 10 minutes.
May it please the court, David Walsh on behalf of Valley View Surgery Center and Nurse Smith. And there are two reasons this court should affirm the decision from the Dallas Court of Appeals and ultimately from the trial court. First, the evidence of let me start with the burden of proof to prove mental incompetence was on Ms. Yancey, and they didn't carry their burden of proof because the evidence is conclusory.
What's conclusory about comatose?
Well, it's
how many years of medical school do you have to go to know what comatose is?
No, and that's not what the Dallas Court of Appeals was really directly attacking as being conclusory. It's the elements from Holliver.
Comatose, your matter of law, unsound mind.
I will concede that for today, okay? But that's not what the Court of Appeals said. It's the continually comatose from the date of the incident, and that's the part that's conclusory. The elements, if we look back to Paula versus McDonald, Phelan versus and Tinkle versus Henderson, those cases that the plaintiff relies on to get them to the mental incompetence, they all require three elements. First is
so a family member could say, I've been with her since this accident, she's been comatose the whole time.
Sure. And we're not
don't need an expert for that.
No. That still may be subject to being conclusory under the court's previous opinions about sometimes statements of fact can be conclusory. But as phrased, someone who is with her every day and saying she doesn't move from her bed or whatever you want to say, that would be sufficient to be there. The problem is we just have the words in the affidavits here of continuous, unremittent or permanent. We don't have anything that gives us any idea of what facts the experts are relying on to get us from point A to point B, being the time when the incident occurred until the lawsuit was filed against these people.
But couldn't you have challenged the guardianship? If you thought, I mean, it sounds to me like the truth of the matter is nobody really questioned this. It was a bit of a gotcha. Nobody has really questioned that she was comatose from the day of surgery and from the accident.
I'm not going to stand here and say that I disagree with that she's comatose.
So why shouldn't we require that if there's going to be any argument about capacity, it has to go through a verified denial, or we're going to challenge it?
Except for, from my client's perspective, they come to the courthouse late in the game. They say, hey, statute of limitations has run, so file a motion for summary judgment. The plaintiff never pled an exception or something to get around the statute of limitations, so we show up at court with our motion for summary judgment. Almost the 21 days goes by, but 9 days before the hearing, they file the affidavit saying, for the first time ever, she's incapacitated and raising this issue. Suddenly, what are we supposed to do with that?
For the first time ever, I mean, she brought suit through her guardian. Doesn't that tell you they're incapacitated?
That may tell me that she's incapacitated, but it doesn't tell me when she's incapacitated. If we look back to the element of continual, we know that there is a time frame when a guardianship sprung up. We don't know that it was 5 years down the road. If you look to
my point is, if you're going to contest that, aren't you required to do that?
I don't think so, because let me give you an example.
From the trial, you've got to prove up that the guardian still should be there, and that's a continuing burden you have to show that the guardianship still needs to remain intact all the way through.
I would say yes, but let me give you an example of where, even under your scenario, where I would challenge the wouldn't challenge the guardianship, and it creates a presumption of continuing incapacity, where it doesn't show from the beginning that it was meet the continual requirement, and that's the case of West versus Moore from the Houston Court of Appeals, where some man had neurosyphilis and his mental status deteriorated all for a period of time until his mom had to take over to be his guardian. The court there said, you know what, at the end, you're right, he is incapacitated, but back when you're complaining about the time frame of when the doctor was negligent, he wasn't incapacitated.
Well, but the affidavit, if it's any good, it says she is in a comatose vegetative state. Based on my review of her medical records, she's been in such a condition consistently and uninterrupted since her brain injury suffered on May 3rd, 2000, while a patient at Valley View Surgery Center. She has been totally disabled continuously since May 3rd, 2000. That's continual.
Oh, except for, what is the basis for the expert to say that?
Personal observation, assessment, interviews, and review of her medical records and diagnoses of her treating physician.
And her personal assessment will give me, essentially from the day she visited, which we know has to spring up after the lawsuit. Well, what does that give me before that? It gives me I've read some medical records, which the court has said basically in Anderson versus Snyder and Burrow versus, I assume it's ours, but
well,
I'm not sure.
Hospital records say 10 minutes without oxygen, non-responsive. I mean, nobody's ever seen her in anything but a vegetative state.
Even Dr. Ramirez in his deposition, which they never told anybody about, but just attached to the summary judgments, Dr. Ramirez says, you know, I've heard she's incapacitated. He doesn't say mental or physical, but I've heard she's incapacitated. And then goes on the very next page of the deposition to say, I don't know because I haven't seen her medical records and I don't, which
let's,
is...
Let's move on just for a moment. And let's assume that she was continually incapacitated and the evidence shows that. What is your argument about the constitutionality of the Medical Liability Act?
Well, that was the issue that Mr. Rodriguez was going to address.
I have one other question, sure, if I may, on limitations. If tolling is properly raised, whatever that means, why doesn't the movement have the burden to disprove it or show that there's no evidence to support it?
That is correct in your ordinary summary judgment procedures. That is not correct for constitutional open courts issues with regard to healthcare liability claims.
Well,
in our summary judgment, we said the statute of limitations has expired, and two, you can't use any tolling provisions. The very language of the statute says that. Their response is then to say, hey, the statute is unconstitutional. And by saying the statute is unconstitutional, we know from Walker versus Gutierrez and other cases, they have the burden to prove the statute is unconstitutional. So in the first step, we met our summary judgment burden. They then have to come forward with sufficient evidence to raise a fact issue to avoid summary judgment. In the ordinary summary judgment process, it's their burden of proof. It's their turn. Second.
So let me just be clear about that. You think that if the movement says this limitations provision and the respondent has raised the constitutionality of it, and the respondent doesn't file a response at all, just doesn't say anything, he can't complain on appeal that this is an unconstitutional statute?
He may legally be able to, but he's got some evidentiary predicates to get into being legally able to say that. Like on the open court's discovery rule type exceptions, he still has to prove when he discovered it or when he reasonably should have discovered it. Same thing would apply here. He's got to prove his predicate of mental incapacity to get to debate whether it is unconstitutional or not.
Or at least raise a fact question.
Exactly. Any other questions about the evidence? The rest of the time I'll reserve to Mr. Rodriguez to talk about the open court's provisions.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Ray Rodriguez and I represent Respondent United Surgical in these petition for review proceedings. I would like to group my remarks into two broad areas. First, explain why open courts is not even applicable in this case. And second, to explain why, even if we do apply open courts, it will not save this lawsuit from the bar of limitations. At the outset, I think it's important to note the factual context of this case. And the facts here really take it out of the paradigm of an open courts case. In any of the decisions we can look at where open courts has been applied, for instance, Sachs versus Lowell, involving a minor legally disabled from bringing a suit, we have a legally, legislatively imposed impossible condition to the bringing of the suit. The legislature does something that disables the plaintiff from bringing an action. In Sachs, it was the fact that a minor can't access the courts. In Nelson and in Neagle, it was the fact that the injuries could not be discovered within the limitations period. In this case, we don't have that impossible condition. The undisputed evidentiary record establishes that Mrs. Yancey, as the guardian, timely brought suit against the anesthesiologist and anesthesiologist practice group. She did so 19 months after the date of treatment.
Why though isn't a guardian like a parent? Minor has a parent, incapacitated person has a guardian. But Sachs says, well, we're not going to depend on parents to sue. And so why should we depend on a guardian to even be appointed?
There is a very, very serious legal and definitional difference. Sachs points out that a parent doesn't have a legal obligation to bring a lawsuit. And in fact, the parent can't be sued for failing to bring a lawsuit. Guardian, completely different. The case law is clear. It's a fiduciary relationship. The statute and the probate code is clear. The guardian has an affirmative duty to bring and litigate those claims. And the guardianship statutes are also clear that the guardian can be sued by the ward for any misdeed or mishandling of the legal affairs of the ward. So it is a difference, and it is a difference with a distinction. The impossible condition here simply is not a predicate element that's just not met here. It's interesting in Weiner versus Wasson, Justice Owen in her dissent, which was joined in by Chief Justice Phillips and Justice Heck, stated that requiring a competent parent or legal guardian to bring suit is not an impossible condition prohibited by the open courts provision. And while some folks might dispute that in the abstract, in this case, it can't be disputed, because that lawsuit was brought 19 months after the date of treatment. And no explanation anywhere in the record why the guardian waited 21 more months before finally suing the facility where the treatment was rendered, and my client is just an affiliated company. No explanation whatsoever. What's also important to remember on the record is when we look back at that lawsuit, timely filed 19 months after the treatment, at pages 14 through 15 of the record, paragraph 5.04 of that original petition, the plaintiff, the guardian, says, I'm reserving the right to add other defendants. So she clearly perceived the potential to add other defendants, but offers us no explanation why she didn't do it within the limitations period.
What if she had? What if she never got a lawyer, didn't have a guardian, and 3 or 4 years ran before she did? Would that be a different case in your view?
If we have strictly an incapacitated plaintiff who does not have a guardian, and is unable to access the court, I think that is a very different scenario.
And what should the rule be there?
I think that kind of scenario where you truly don't have ability to access the courts is going to be a lot closer to the court's decision in Ruiz versus Conoco and Sachs versus Vogler.
And so then should the overarching rule be you look at all the circumstances, or there's some outer time limit? The dissent in Wasson talked about maybe some reasonable time. What do you think the rule should be?
Well, I think it definitely is a fact and circumstances test. Every case is going to be judged differently. Do I think that the Constitution mandates a perpetual tolling of limitations? I don't believe so. I believe that that's why the legislature, in its action, as this court construed in Ruiz versus Conoco, made the legislative choice to potentially leave limitations open in perpetuity. But I don't think the open courts provision requires that. And certainly this court's decisions in cases like Shaw versus Moss and others say it's only a reasonable time within which to bring the claim. It is not a perpetual tolling as Mr. Denny in his briefs suggested, but now has retreated from a bit, suggesting that the court should draw some lines.
Open courts require some balancing. So you look on the one hand to the considerations in support of the statute, and the legislature has reenacted this provision now 3 times, each a little differently, saying we really have to have this to protect these other interests. Do you think it makes any difference after Sachs that the legislature has come back twice and said, no, we've looked at, presumably, we've looked at all this again, and this is really important. This has got to be done.
I think that's absolutely an important consideration here, that you have a consistent pattern of clearly stated legislative will and balancing of the policy interests. A very important policy, as this court noted in the Owens Corning versus Carter case, is the policy favoring barring of stale claims. That's an important and legitimate interest that's advanced by the statutes of limitations. That's why in Owens versus Carter, this court upheld the adoption of other states' statutes of limitations that would bar claims that wouldn't be barred in this court. If we apply the balancing here, Justice Heck, I think this case is not controlled by Sachs versus Vogler. It shows you exactly the opposite result. First, I'd say there's no abrogation of a common law right here because the guardian has brought suit and apparently recovered a satisfactory settlement from the anesthesiology defendant. So she has had access to common law remedy. Second, we know that the guardianship code provides an alternate form of remedy available to her. And three, I think one of the justices noted, there might be a potential claim against other professional advisors if there's some basis for it. And I would suggest there isn't in this case. And furthermore, what's important here is Sachs, you have the court saying we can't rely on the mere possibility that a parent or an interested person is timely going to file suit. That's not enough. We don't have a mere possibility here. We have an actual timely filed lawsuit. And really, the core piece here that makes this case different from any other is the presence of the guardian, which removes the legal disability of the ward. Ruiz versus Conoco, the court was very careful to say that it was not adopting a blanket rule that you couldn't preclude a claim brought by a guardian. The court specifically reserved that, and so there could be circumstances where the action or inaction of the guardian would preclude the suit. Tingle, which is a writ refused case, is even more direct to the point. There, the court noted that it was appropriate not to bar the claims by limitations, also because there was no timely appointed guardian. There was no guardian at the time of the alleged injury. The suggestion is if there had been one, then you run limitations. The Temple case is also important because it notes as to some of these cases dealing with municipalities or Tort Claims Act cases, the case law holding that those notice provisions are going to be told during minority absent removal of the disability, removal of the disability to access the courts. That's what happened here. There was a removal of the disability and an accessing of the courts, fully independent of the evidentiary challenges and those disputes that Mr. Walsh has spoken with you about. So we would submit that the balancing test under Sachs and Vogler is satisfied if you decide you need to go to the balancing test. If somehow the court determines that maybe it's a close call on balancing, United Surgical submits that the limitations period in the lower court's judgment should nonetheless be sustained because the limitations period here has been a valid exercise of the police power. And that analysis, that paradigm, goes all the way back to 1955. The Lebholm case versus City of Galveston, it was talked about in Chief Justice Phillips' dissent in the Lucas case, and also in the dissent in Weiner versus Wasson, which is, yes, we do the balancing, but even if you don't satisfy the balancing, it's not over yet. You take the separate inquiry and you take a look at valid exercise of police power. Under these facts, under the circumstances presented here, we think it's infinitely reasonable to require that the guardian timely file suit. We haven't had any explanation why it wasn't done. And it may be mere speculation, but it may be that the guardian sat down with her lawyers and they said, you know, we've done a thorough examination of the facts and we don't think there's a good faith basis to sue these entities. Our recommendation is not to. What do you want to do? The guardian says, I don't want to bring a frivolous lawsuit. Let's leave them out of it. That very well could have happened. And if that's the case, simply because we have new lawyers who have new litigation strategies and new ideas, doesn't mean that we should toll the limitations or that there's been some kind of constitutional violation. Finally, I'd note, even if the court were to determine there's been an open courts violation, the lawsuit here is not safe. Shaw versus Moss says, all you get is a reasonable time to bring the lawsuit. In Shaw versus Moss, the court held unreasonable as a matter of law a delay of 17 months from discovery of the suit of the injury to institution of the suit. Here we have an unexplained delay of 21 months. No reason why this case should not be controlled by the bright lines that have already been established in prior case law. I would also note that the Shaw decision cites favorably other decisions where time periods as short as 15 months or 12 months have been held to be an unreasonable delay. Finally, as to the other due process challenges on objections and late filed replies, I'd just like to note that they're an opposite as to my client. My client did not file any objections. My client did not file any reply. So if the court resolves the open courts issue as to my client, certainly it should affirm. We pray that the lower court's decisions be in all things affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Rodriguez.
Mr. Rodriguez made a, seems to me, a fairly compelling argument that the case should stand just on the Shaw decision alone.
My recollection of the Shaw decision, Your Honor, is that it did not involve a totally incompetent, comatose person. And I think, I don't know why the lawyer did not sue these other defendants within the proper time period, but I think this suggests that if there was no guardian and no lawsuit, he told it, but because the guardian initiates mother, of course, there's obvious other issues, and he was going to depend on this lawyer. And it's really not Miss Yancey, the guardian, it's really Miss Yates. Miss Yates can't control her lawyer. The fact that the lawyer didn't sue the right parties, and she should not be at the mercy of this lawyer when she has no mental incapacity to judge what she's doing. And she's certainly not going to sue her mother, who is frankly broke from taking care of her daughter. I mean, so the mother is the parent, and I think really is more analogous to a parent over a minor child than a guardian. This isn't a professional guardian, a retained guardian. It's her mother. It's a parent.
How do you answer the position or the response that the disability was lifted when the guardian was appointed?
I think that's not the case. I don't think that you become undisabled because you have a guardian. Ms. Yates, still as a practical matter, you just look at it, has no mental capacity whatsoever. She can do absolutely nothing. Went from school teacher to lying in bed breathing. And I think that she should not be at the mercy of her lawyer or her guardian in this situation. There was no strategy decision not to sue these individuals. I think in this case that, again, it makes no sense that had all it does is encourage, well, if you don't have a guardian and you don't file suit, then the limitation just runs way out here. But if you have a guardian, then all of a sudden it's going to have this punitive effect. You better do everything right. And again, Ms. Yates can't control that. And this isn't a case where we're having a battle of the experts over the incapacity. It's undisputed. She clearly has no capacity whatsoever.
What makes it difficult is that she also had a lawyer. You're asking us to, you're asking us to forgive the lawyer for his malfeasance or misfeasance.
No, that's not the case. And perhaps there's a joint issue here. The lawyer has taken a position that it was told, so joining the party is not a problem. That was his response to why weren't they joined. But in a sense, it does kind of let the lawyer off the hook if he made a mistake, but certainly the tolling rule has not been settled by this court. It's an open question. So I think the lawyer did commit malpractice. I think he should have joined these parties and not relied on an unsettled tolling question. So I guess...
That lawsuit's told, okay? So this one's over.
Yes, that one is clearly told. That is correct.
Thank you, Counselor. The cause is submitted in court. Brief recess.
Thank you, Your Honor.